Hello and welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is a Swedish author and philanthropist. She's the editor and publisher of Granta Magazine and Granta Books. She's also the founder of her own trust, a grant-making foundation set up to support human rights. 5 years ago, the body of her drug-dependent sister-in-law was discovered in her Chelsea home. In her latest powerful memoir, Mayhem, my guest today tries to make sense of the tragedy that shook her family to the core. Sigrid Rousing, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Thanks so much for coming in. I know that we've chatted before a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And since then, of course, many things have happened in your life. One thing, of course, is Granta has gone from strength to strength. The literary journal absolutely flourishing. And, of course, your imprint, Granta Publishing, doing extremely well. I wanted to go back to the beginning, because in this memoir, Mayhem, you start off in your childhood, which seems a wonderful place full of mm-hmm. ponies and endless Swedish summer holidays. Mm-hmm. And I thought it would be useful for us to know a little bit about the Rousing family, because, of course, you're very well known.
So my grandfather started a packaging company called Åkerlund & Rousing, and out of that company, Tetra Pak grew. My father ran it, and during his time, it grew from 5 people to 36,000 people. And we lived in the academic town of Lund, which is a bit like Cambridge in Sweden. It's the southern of the two academic towns.
So the childhood that you describe in the book sounds idyllic. Tell us about it from your perspective.
I think it was idyllic, and especially in the summers. We had 2 months off from school, and none of us liked school very much. And so during that time, there was a sense of extraordinary freedom, of exploration, of peace, of doing nice and fun things. So my memories from that time are all good memories. And I write a little bit in the book about, you know, what it's like going back to that place. Insofar as the book has a physical setting, that is the place. Mm.
Because you still have a home there, don't you?
We still have a home, and it's a very mysterious and beautiful place. It's a common, and it's also a nature reserve. And I write about, you know, the somewhat surreal nature of going back to a place where you grew up, which, you know, I left 35 years ago, and of occasionally bumping into people I knew when I was a child or teenager, you know, and the kind of sense in which time warps when that happens, you know. It's like no time has passed. It's like lifetimes have passed, you know.
Yeah. You also write about sort of pressure to succeed. And I wonder how difficult it was for you coming from this family in which there had been very great success. And I know that both you and your sister are academic.
I mean, I think there's a gendered aspect to that. My mother was an academic and both of my grandmothers were teachers. And so I think we all unconsciously model ourselves on our parents, you know. I think that was much harder for my brother, you know, because my father was such an exceptional leader, really. But I think, you know, this was also the 60s and 70s, and I write about that, and I write about the, you know, the kind of sense of freedom and the unstructured time that we had, and almost the opposite of pressure. There was a lot of freedom in those days. Mm.
You chose to follow an academic path. And in fact, your first book, History, Memory and Identity in Post-Soviet Estonia, The End of a Collective Farm. That was actually part of your thesis, was it?
Yes. So that was my thesis rewritten as a monograph, as a book.
You actually spent a year living on this farm.
Yes, I spent a year living on a collective farm in Estonia in 1993-94. And when I say that, you know, a collective farm in the Soviet context, of course, means a collection of pre-war farms that were put together as one entity. So actually, you know, I lived in a village, which was the center of this entity, as mm-hmm. it were. And it was the time of Jeffrey Sachs's shock therapy for, you know, the former Soviet Union. And so the economic life in this village was almost zero, you know, the economic activity had just dwindled, and it was very hard for people, but a very interesting time for me.
In the 80s, I think, your family moved from Sweden to Britain. You studied in Britain. And then along came Granta. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that.
Well, Eric, my husband, and I had already started a publishing house called Portobello Books with Philip Green Jones. This was in the early spring of 2005. And in the summer of 2005, Ray Hederman, who owns the New York Review of Books and owned Granta as well, came to see us to ask if we had any interest in acquiring Granta. And we thought about it for a long time. And in the end, we decided to do it. And so that was how it happened.
And have you enjoyed it? Because I know you now edit the journal yourself.
Yes, I mean, of course. So I started out as the publisher of the magazine. And in 2013, when John Freeman left, I took over as acting editor. And that was really just because there was nobody else around, you know, and we were looking around for another editor. But at that point, I had already started to edit a lot of the pieces coming in, and I was very involved in the whole process. And I found that I was really enjoying it, and it was something I could do. And so the acting editorship remained in place for some time, and then I think in the spring we decided that I was going to, in fact, just take on the editorship.
While all this was going on, of course, you had your own tragedy going on in the background, and this was all down to your brother Hans. So tell us about how his life had evolved since leaving Sweden.
So he became an addict when he was quite young, and then had many, many trips in and out of various rehabs and many relapses. And he then eventually ended up in this one rehab where he had a full recovery, if you can call it that, and where he met Eva, his wife-to-be. And at that point, they were very happy. You know, they were happy. They got engaged, they got married.
She was American?
She was American, though born in Hong Kong. And she'd grown up in London, really. They had four children. They were very active in the world of recovery. They were very active philanthropically. We saw each other a lot. They had a wonderful life.
Until one New Year, where they had a glass of champagne, as people do.
Yeah. And as recovering addicts knew not to do.
And what happened then?
And that was really the beginning of the relapse. And I don't mean by that they immediately started taking lots of drugs, because I think a relapse is a state of mind as much as anything else. And it was a very gradual process. But they eventually were taking very serious amounts of drugs. And we were increasingly worried about them, at times frantic about them, trying to plead with them, trying to intervene. You know, there's the concept of interventions where you go together as a family and speak to the addict to try and, you know, bring about change, rehab normally.
And because you write about how family entanglement is part of the disease of addiction.
It is part of the disease of addiction. And I think, you know, there's a concept of codependency, which is, you know, when you get so drawn into the addiction that you can't, that your own independent life, as it were, gets sucked into the vortex of this terrible tragedy unfolding in front of your eyes.
So, ostensibly, a successful, happy, good-looking couple, beautiful house in central London, four children, mm-hmm. and yet all of this going on. Eventually, you could see that it was unsustainable for them to keep the children.
Yeah. In 2006, Eva, in particular, was in a very bad way. And she ended up with blood poisoning, probably from dirty needles. And she had to have an emergency heart operation. And it was really life-threatening. I mean, she could easily have died at that time. And partly because they didn't quite notice how ill she was. So it just became harder and harder. And, you know, one of the reasons for that, of course, is that addicts resist help as much as they can, because to them, the drugs are the help. If you're an addict, the idea of help is not to go off to rehab. That's an idea of deprivation. And families trying to help can be seen, and I think we were seen, as oppressive, you know. And so, you know, the whole question of power, of guilt, of family disputes becomes part of the whole syndrome.
You mentioned that she had heart problems, she had this operation. There's a wonderful scene that you write that you come back to a couple of times of her looking in the mirror with her pacemaker under her chest and just sort of looking. And it's a wonderful snapshot, really, of who she was and her relationship with you. It seems quite a fond moment.
Oh, a very fond moment. But, you know, I have many fond moments of Eva. And in fact, as I was writing the book, I felt closer and closer to her too, you know, because I felt that I understood her better. I got more, I think, in the process of writing and thinking about things and talking about things. I kind of understood more of who she was, you know.
I guess what must have been very difficult then for your relationship with her was the fate of the children. How did you manage to put them in a place of safety?
Oh, through a terrifying and deeply damaging court case. You know, deeply damaging for all of us.
Mm. But they ended up living with you?
Yes.
And are with you still?
Yes.
Yeah. So that kind of set the tone, really, for your relationship with Eva, if not with your brother. In the book, you share with us a lot of the emails and the conversations that she had. And I think you kept diaries, too, at the time what was going on. And she sounds very ill.
I think she was very ill. I think she was helplessly angry. I think she was very paranoid from the drugs she was taking, you know, crack and cocaine in her case. And I think she was also, you know, a lot of these communications came in the middle of the night. And I think she was also kind of playing, you know. I think there was a sense in which none of it was quite real to her, you know. But I think what was real was her rage, her anger, the loss of the children, you know.
This continued, the children now safe, but Hans and Eva living on in London. She did try. She went off to rehab again, didn't she? She went off to America.
She did. And I write in my book that, you know, I felt hope at that time. I think there was hope at that time. I think that she had made some decisions about taking back her own name, going to rehab. But, you know, as so often happens with addiction, the death is almost accidental. You know, you can die of an accidental overdose, or in her case, her heart condition, really at any time, you know, even at the point of recovery.
And, of course, she did die. Tell us the circumstances.
Well, I mean, we don't know all the circumstances. What we do know is that her heart started beating at an extraordinary rate, and that rate is really explicable only by an inhalation of cocaine or crack cocaine.
And of course you know this because her pacemaker recorded it.
The pacemaker recorded it and had also recorded previous instances of this. And so the course of death is quite clear.
After Eva's death, your brother Hans was not able to face it, and I think ignored it, tried to put it out of his mind, and her body lay undiscovered for a while in their home until, in fact, he was arrested for driving erratically. And that, of course, then led to the police coming back to his home to look for drugs and then finding Eva's body that had been there probably for a couple of months.
Yeah.
That must have been very distressing for everybody involved.
Oh, I mean, it was a horrendous shock. I can't begin to describe it, you know. And I remember speaking to a policeman who was at a house and I asked him how long the body had been there. And he said in such a kind voice, he said, "I think it's weeks rather than days." And I was so grateful for that kindness, you know. But, I mean, I it's indescribable, you know. I mean, because first of all, grief for Eva, you know, the loss of Eva, knowing that we would have to tell the children. And secondly, the shock of what had happened, you know, the idea of her body. And then thirdly, the kind of horrendous media scene that unraveled from that.
You write in the book about your own depression and that actually you were very rattled by this.
Yeah, though the scenes of my own depression were really set earlier in my mid-20s. In my mid-20s, I had a very serious depression, more or less coinciding with the time of my brother going into recovery at the rehab. It's a very common thing that family members become depressed at that time, you know, because as soon as you know that the person you love is safe, you can begin to kind of let go a little bit. I think it's important that it's in the book because depression and addiction are very much twins of each other, you know.
I expect, I mean, obviously Hans was going through the most appalling time himself. After the discovery of her body, it was clear he too was very unwell at that time, but received treatment.
Yes, he did. Not straight away. I mean, I think he had about 24 hours of being in a police cell and being in a terrible state of withdrawal, which actually they thought afterwards might have killed him, because he was at that time very, very deep in his opiate addiction.
Mm. You write about the nature of privilege and how pleasure and pain walk a little apart. I found that very affecting and very, very poignant in his case, because obviously there was this great privilege, but also this huge wells of pain.
I mean, I think privilege is interesting, and obviously, you know, addiction is no respecter of privilege, you know, but it's not obviously caused by privilege or underprivilege for that matter. But, you know, I think there is maybe a tendency towards a certain isolation or a certain reclusiveness, you know, or, you know, you can get more help on the one hand, but you're also more scrutinized on the other, you know.
Mm, absolutely. In the introduction, you write about feeling attacked, coming under attack, and how really anything bad that people would say about the story, you've already thought, you've been through this. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is something, it's such a deeply personal story and clearly one that's still very difficult for you. Why write about it?
There's a quote in the book, which is from Ishmael Reed, who's quoting George Bernard Shaw. And he says something like, tell your own stories, because if you don't, others will tell them for you. Mm. And they will vulgarize and degrade you in the process. And that was, of course, very much the case for us. The tabloids, or I should say the media, because there wasn't a great distinction between the tabloids and the broadsheet press. The media kind of owned this story. And there was even in Sweden an opera about it that I described briefly in the book. And so it felt as though everybody knew what this was all about, you know. And I wanted to add something to that story, something truthful, something that I'd thought about and talked about.
You write, in fact, you quote Orwell, and you're talking about how love leads to enabling collusion. I thought that that was really interesting. And the whole thing about, is it, do you give tough love? Do you give no love?
Mm-hmm.
And how that can feed addiction.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's more complicated than that. Mm-hmm. But certainly, I mean, I start the book with a quote from Orwell. And so the quote is, perhaps one didn't want to be loved so much as to be understood. Mm. It's a very complicated quote because it comes at a time when Winston, the hero, is being tortured. And the torture is part of a brainwashing technique. And so we can assume that even that thought is part of the brainwashing. Mm. You know, that Winston will come to love his interrogator. And of course we know that that is how interrogation works. But I think, you know, the question of love, you know, most families with addiction are kind of split into doves and hawks, you know, doves believing in unlimited love and the hawks believing in tough love. And those disputes can become very bitter. And in our case, they did become very bitter, you know. You know, I was always puzzled by this idea of what does love even mean in this context?
Mm.
You know, what does it mean? And what are the links with enabling, you know? And isn't it, in fact, better to try and hear people and understand them and think about them than to claim that you love them? You know, the love doesn't seem to me to be something that one should speak about necessarily. It can be there, but it shouldn't be used as a weapon.
And of course, feeding into all of that is guilt, almost like a survivor guilt, I suppose.
A bit of survivor guilt, but I think also a sense in which there's guilt in every addiction story. Part of the reason for guilt is that causation is so unclear still, and parents in particular are often implicated in causation. And so, you kind of think about, or parents think about, the siblings too, we thought about, what did we do? What had we done to cause this? How could things have been different? And, of course, many addicts have a tendency to, I would say, weaponize their own weakness too, so that the fragility of the addict becomes part of the whole discourse of why they became addicts, can become quite self-pitying. And which is why the AA and the NA, Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, focus on, not on causation, but just straightforwardly on addiction being a disease. Because if we just say it's a disease, we don't have to engage in those narratives of blame. And blame and denial, shame and guilt are absolutely part of every addiction story.
Yeah. Hans and Eva were very active when they were sober in various charities dealing with rehab. And you point out that it's very difficult, particularly the financial divide, the way that people access both the law and rehab. Mm-hmm. If you're rich, it's entirely different from if you're poor. Mm-hmm. And I think that they did a lot of work in that, trying to get adequate help for people.
Yeah, they certainly did.
And you go on to talk about the hamster wheel of interventions and mm-hmm. regrets. Mm-hmm. It just sounds an interminable journey, really.
And I think that's what it's like for people. And I think, it doesn't matter very much whether you're wealthy or whether you're not wealthy. Mm. This thing about, you do an intervention. Was it too harsh? Did you say too much? Did it help or did it not help? Those are very stark choices, thoughts, ideas that you are faced with.
Mm. The book is very, very moving. It's not without its moments of humour as well, I have to say. I love the one line where you talk about enough morphine to kill a small horse, and then you wonder about how horses do actually react to morphine. How much morphine would that be? It's just there are lots of sort of lovely lovely moments, particularly between you and your husband, Eric Abraham, who is a filmmaker. And there's wonderful sort of, it's clear there's enormous sort of love and support there, but also kind of great humour and great banter between the two of you.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think that must have been a great support to you.
Oh, a great support to me, yeah. And Eric, we were all so drawn into this vortex, and Eric kind of managed to stay on the outside, so he, I think, had a much clearer vision of what was going on, So his voice in the book is very much the voice of reason.
Yeah, and that very much comes across. You also talk about just being constantly vigilant, always watching yourself and your own child and Eva's children for some kind of shadow of that genetic fault coming through.
Because, we know for a fact that alcohol addiction is heritable, not entirely heritable, but 50 to 70% heritable. And it's thought that all addictions are heritable in a similar way. And so, of course, it's something to worry about if you have addiction in the family.
After Eva's death, information came out that she had been in contact with various newspapers and investigators. And she was talking about the death of the Swedish leader, Olof Palme, who was murdered. And she had various allegations to do with your family.
So in her grief and the loss of the children and so on, her anger with all of us, and particularly with my father, Eva had the idea that my father was behind us taking steps to remove the children. So she was particularly angry with him. And about a year before she died, she accused my father to a Swedish journalist of being behind the assassination of Olof Palme. And almost everything she said in those emails was not true. She made statements about the type of weapon, about where Palmer was shot. Everything was wrong. She said that she knew this because she'd seen it in a vision, that she'd died, come back to life. She was talking about a heart operation, and that since that time she saw visions. And there were many other visions that, you know, reached us along the way. But the journalist who received the emails, Gunnar Wall, didn't do anything with them for a year. But when she died, he took them to the newspapers. And at that time, of course, they had become a commodity. They had become a valuable commodity. The newspapers, the tabloids in particular, in Sweden, made much of this. And they were also printed in England, you know, but not just by the tabloids, also by The Guardian, by The Times. And so the story is kind of growing and growing.
And is there an end to it?
I think it's over now. I mean, it's very complicated. And part of it, what happened was that after several months of this, I thought, naively, I have to add, I thought I'll go to the police and I'll explain a bit about, you know, what had been happening. And then they'll get it and it will be an end to it. But that decision, and I did do that, that decision ended up in the police asking me to come in and sign a statement, which I resisted for a long time. But eventually I agreed. They said to me, you know, all you have to do is come in, sign the statement, and then we can put an end to it. You know, so they were kind of agreeing with me that this was an absurd thing, but they needed that statement to be able to stop. And also to send a signal to the media to stop the speculation. So eventually I said yes. 5 days after I said yes, there were tabloid headlines. And in Sweden, the headlines are posted on the street as posters saying Sigrid Rasing to be interrogated by police about Palmer murder. Never in my wildest imagination did I ever think that my name would be on the streets of Stockholm as somebody to be interrogated about Olof Palme's murder in 1986. So this is how crazy the whole story became. And part of the reason for that I discuss a bit in the book, but I don't go into it great length, is that, you know, the Palmer murder and all serious murders in Sweden are now open in perpetuity. And that means that there's very little information about what the police are actually doing. There's a small Palmer group sifting through evidence, and the evidence is all tips from people coming in. And so it just shows you how the combination of the media that we have here and in Sweden, the combination of wealth and drugs and a culture of Scandinoir, you know, Nordic noir, you know, here was a capitalist, here was a woman who was dead, here was a woman who was enraged by him and who had also talked wildly about being afraid of him. And I have to say, for no reason at all, my father is a very benign person. But it became, our lives became a fiction.
The mayhem of the title, would you say it's now over? Where is Hans Christian now?
So he's remarried, he's doing well. I think the mayhem is over, though there's a bit of mayhem around this book, of course. You know, a lot of headlines, a lot of unwanted stories.
It's a very, very brave book to have written. Do you feel better for having done it?
I feel much better for having done it, for having written it. I mean, there's several aspects to it. There's the writing, there's the thinking about things and talking about things. Writing, and you know, that was very cathartic. And I came from a situation of kind of great, a sense that I didn't know anything and everything was very foggy and unclear and there were obfuscations and lies, and into a place of great clarity. And I think, you know, the hallmark of addiction, one of the hallmarks of addiction, is this sense of fogginess, you know. And so it was a kind of wonderful thing to gain clarity, to gain knowledge. Publishing the book, of course, was a different matter, and that's been quite difficult. But I felt a bit as though there was a fish hook in my finger and I had to push it through, you know, rather than leave it there or try and pull it out, you know. And I also think, you know, I mean, I speak as somebody who suffers from depression. Pain is not the worst thing. The worst thing is trying to cover up the pain.
Mayhem is a memoir by Sigrid Rousing. It's published by Penguin. This week's episode of Meet the Writers was produced by George McDonough, researched by Daphne Karnitsis. And you can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, MixCloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.